This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Robin Coleman of Peace, Love and Pets speaks with Sarah Tomasetti, key organizer for Wine for Paws.
Well, I had this idea that what if they just donate 1% of sales one day to Woods Humane Society, and the wineries were just so into it, and it went from one day in 2009 to a whole weekend.
Then, author Sean Weir talks to Tom Wilmer about his days working at a California vineyard.
That harvest, we assembled kind of a random team of cellar rats and other assorted itinerant individuals, and we all came together as a unit and just had just a great time.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 17th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with an interview with Suzanne Rostock, director of Following Harry, a documentary about the life of singer, actor, and activist Harry Belafonte. She spoke with KCSB reporter Kelly Duroc about her lifelong friendship with Belafonte and the importance of art in social justice work.
One of the documentary films featured during the 40th annual Santa Barbara International Film Festival was Suzanne Rostock's film Following Harry, which chronicles the last 12 years of Mr. Harry Belafonte's life and activism. This film follows her 2011 film, Sing Your Song, which also examines the life of Mr. Belafonte. I spoke with Suzanne Rostock to discuss her experience creating the film, the messages included throughout, her history as a filmmaker, as well as her friendship with Mr. Belafonte.
Hi, Suzanne. It's so nice to meet with you. How did the experience of creating a film of this nature differ from your previous film following Mr. Belafonte?
It differed greatly. When I made the first film, I didn't really know Harry, and he came to me, and I entered that project. It had been started some years before, and I came and redesigned it and got to know him as I was making that film. And that film was really, although I tried to cut it in a style that's not traditional biopic, that's what it was. It was a biopic, and it took from the beginning of his life to 2008. But at the end of that film, Harry invited me to share an office with him. He was moving into a new office. And by that point, we had become friends. And so then sharing an office with Harry developed an automatic intimacy and comfort in our relationship. So there was a difference. There's always discovery, even if you've known a person for 40 years, you discover something new. But this was, I was on the inside of his life, and I saw him every single day. And at the end of most days, he would come into my end of the office and sit down, and usually bringing a glass of rum, Mount K rum. And he'd come and sit down and give me my little inch of rum. And he would either share jokes or whatever was on his mind. And he was troubled. He was troubled about the world. That was 2010 then. And he, at the end of Sing Your Song, Harry says, "What do you do now?" And that was a question that I was really thinking about a lot.
Yeah.
And so was he. And one day, one evening, as he sat there, he started to cry. And he said, "I have so little time left, and I feel like I've failed. I haven't done enough. I don't know what to do." And I said, "Well, you're doing something every day, because there's so many different people coming into our office." And they were coming for advice from him and trying to learn how to do more. And, you know, Prince would come, Bruce Springsteen, Bon Jovi, but not just rock stars. There were politicians and artists and poets and just everyone imaginable, a lot of young people coming for advice, trying to figure out what to do. And then with the death, murder, really, of Trayvon Martin, Harry just hit the ground running. That was kind of a very long answer to your...
But that's definitely a very different approach, I mean, going into it.
I was there witness to all of this, and I was trusted. So nothing was a performance. It just was. And I know the orange sweatshirt interview that's woven throughout the film, it's something that Harry called me up one morning and he said, "Come over for breakfast." And I said, "Okay, I'll come for breakfast," which was not unusual. But I said, "But I have my cameraman and sound man here, and we were going to go off and shoot something, but I'm going to come to you first if I can bring my crew.
Yeah.
Because I have some questions that I've always wanted to ask you. Because I never interviewed him, you know, mm-hmm. we'd have conversations. So I said, I'm not coming with a sheet of questions, but there are things that have been on my mind to mm-hmm. ask you. And he said, well, I haven't shaved yet. I said, good. Don't. Yeah. And he had his orange sweatshirt on.
Yep.
And so that which becomes almost the armature for my film, mm-hmm. was all contained in like a 7-hour interview, you know, just went on and we just covered a lot of, and I think that created a tremendous intimacy for the film, because as I was thinking, he was thinking, you could see his gestures, or, you know, he's thinking about the answers. And originally, I was going to call it Ruminations, mm-hmm. A postcard to the future. So it's going to be just little segments of conversations. And I thought maybe I'd do it, you know, podcasts were just beginning. So
yeah.
I thought maybe that would be kind of a cool, like, who's in Harry's office
yeah.
today? So that's kind of the process.
Something that Mr. Belafonte says in the film, and, you know, sort of a recurring message that he continues to convey, not only in the film, but of course in his life as well, was, quote, artists are gatekeepers of truth. We are civilization's radical voice, end quote. Why was that such an important message for you to drive home throughout the entire film? And, you know, how did that resonate with you as a filmmaker and as an artist as well?
Well, I think the message has always, even before I heard the message, mm-hmm. has guided what I do in life, because I feel that the arts are so powerful mm-hmm. and that they're really one of the most effective ways of creating change, because the arts are a universal language. And you're up front, you're recognized, you know, especially performers, actors, and musicians. And they can just reach so many people in one moment. And also with film, when you sit for 90 minutes in a dark room, you have a real experience as if you're really living it. And you can transform the way a person thinks about life. So effective. So the idea that the gatekeepers of truth, civilization's radical voice, is a call to the responsibility of the artist.
Yeah.
That we have this ability, and in some cases this incredible power, and it's our duty as a human to use it for the better good. And so Harry constantly saying that is reminding, you know, it's like when he confronted Jamie Foxx, that Harry said, you know, me and Sydney, we've been wondering, you know, what happened to you guys? And Jamie says, well, we want the house on the hill and the mm-hmm. shiny car and all that.
Yeah,
but I understand, he says, we understand we have to do more. It's our responsibility to do more. Because he always talked about himself being an activist first and then an mm-hmm. artist. But when he recognized the power of his art was when he performed on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Mm-hmm.
He was very young and he sang Scarlet Ribbons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really one of the first times a black person was in a variety show like that, that was really directed towards white people. And the fact that he was singing a lullaby about a child, his mm-hmm. child, looking
yeah.
at in on his child as she was kneeling in prayer, that color disappeared for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
They just saw him as a great performer, and he recognized the power of that, that he had a platform,
Absolutely.
He had a stage that people would pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when he started his rallying call to all the other artists. He brought so many of those artists to the March on Washington. You know, that really was a wake-up call to other artists.
Throughout the documentary, nearly every person who recounts their experiences with Mr. Belafonte explains, you know, how much he directly impacted the way that they moved forward with their life following a lot of those interactions. And I wanted to ask, what was it specifically about him that did that for you? Maybe, you know, before your first film, when you initially met him, that was kind of that spark in that moment for you.
You know, I've been asked that before, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, except that he, you know, I know that he sacrificed so much. He could have just been famous,
mm-hmm.
just been happy with his fame. But his humanity and his love for humanity and his concern for justice for everyone really moved me so
mm-hmm.
much. You know, I grew up with parents who felt that way also, so it wasn't unique for me to see that in an adult. But it was a reminder to me that I just had to stay the path. And the fact that he just never gave up. He didn't take no. And he said what was on his mind. He didn't dance around things. And his strength is just his overwhelming belief in justice. Mm-hmm. Was very inspiring, you know. It made it impossible for me to say, no, I'm just going to do something easy.
Yeah, no,
I'm not going to take the easy way out.
Were there any off-screen moments that you shared with Mr. Belafonte or anyone else in the film that you think you'll remember most coming out of this project?
Well, what I remember most is really how emotional Harry was. Mm-hmm. And how, I wouldn't say that he cried easily, but he was really moved to tears by so much that he witnessed, that he couldn't say no to people. He never turned anybody down. He always showed up. You know, in the section in Sing Sing where Sean Pica, who had, you know, spent most of his life in prison starting when he was 16, and Sean calls him up, asks if he'll come to a graduation. Mm-hmm. And Harry went every year until probably 2 years before his death. I mean, mm-hmm. He just always showed up. And there was no question.
Yeah.
He didn't contemplate should he or shouldn't. He just did. He showed up. And so the behind-the-scenes private moments were really his public moments, except the way I opened the film. Now, that was a very private moment, and I didn't show it in sync because it was just so raw. I showed some of it, mm-hmm. you know, where he said, I don't know who I am. But the earlier part where he said, you know, I have so little time left, and I'm wondering how to evaluate my life. Those were the openness about his fragility mm-hmm. was painful and beautiful. I think, you know, Nick was on this great shoot, the party bus shoot, when we were going up to have the conversation about creating Action Lab. Mm-hmm. So we were... he didn't want to just be driven in a car. He wanted a big bus.
Yeah.
So we had one of these stretch SUVs with mm-hmm. trace lights. And we just blasted music the whole time. And he's just rocking out.
Yeah. You know?
And have that little moment in the film mm-hmm. where he's singing and goes woo, you know. But the whole trip up there was like that. And so the joy he felt, and you know, he was an exuberant human being. He was also in deep pain about the way the world was going. Yeah. But there was so much joy in him also, and he was like a big kid.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun to be with him. And he would dance around the office. When I was a child, I had a very short-lived career as a tap dancer. So and Harry taps, you know, so he would sometimes come in my office and we'd do a little step shuffle.
Oh, it's beautiful. That's so fun.
So it was fun in the office. We had a lot of joy in the office and laughter.
On, I guess, a more serious note, one of the things that, you know, Mr. Belafonte did, he was never overlooking the harshness and complexity of the issues that he addressed. You know, he's consistently drawing on wisdom of his past memories, past experiences, and sharing them with those who are trying to navigate the present, whether it's, you know, the Ferguson protests, the death of Trayvon Martin, Women's March, the election. I remember he said in the beginning of the film, the civil rights movement never ended. It took a deep breath for a moment. How do these words from Mr. Belafonte motivate you as a documentary filmmaker to continue to shed light on these issues?
You know, I've spent over 50 years now making documentaries about human rights mm-hmm. issues and art and life, just life and injustice. Injustice is woven through just about everything I've done. And in that is so much history. And what I come to see, and I recognize that fairly early on, actually, is that people don't know history. They have no idea what's come before. Mm-hmm. And no offense, but young people especially, you're not taught it. You're not taught it in the school. It's not part of your life to know what came before. And so that with each generation, or even each half generation, everybody's trying to reinvent the wheel instead of building on what's come before mm-hmm. and learn.
Yeah.
And so that's my motivation, is to teach, help people recognize what's come before. And if you do it in the right way, you're successful with it, if you feel like you've experienced it, you understand it, and you recognize the importance, then you use it. And the other part of that is that so much of history has not been documented. And I know, especially with women, there's very little documentation of what women have done. And you look at the civil rights movement, and there's so little there of women. You know, some people know Fannie Lou Hamer, very few, and Diane Nash and women like that, who were essential to the movement and were the architects. And so I had decided that I didn't want that to ever happen again. So right before I started following Harry, I started making a film called Another Night in the Free World, which I decided to document the lives of three young women activists and just follow them over a long period of time to get the whole arc of their life and what it is to be a woman and an activist, and which is why that whole segment in the Women's March, about the Women's March, is in this, because that's, I was filming it for the other film, and will be in the other film too, but from a different perspective.
Yeah.
So I wanted that people can actually witness history as it's being created.
Was there any moment in the film or anything that possibly sparked an idea for, you know, a different project or something that you plan to incorporate maybe in a future film of yours?
You know, there are a million films that I could make coming out of that film, but I'm in the middle of three other films.
Yeah.
So I'm trying not to think of other films I could make now based on that. But what I did come away with, and I come away with it always with every film I've made, because to backtrack just a little bit, I worked for 20-some-odd years with Michael Apted, who was an English director who passed away 2 years ago. But he was my hero before I met him, so it was amazing that he came to me and we joined forces. But he did a series called the Up Series, and it started with seven-year-old children in England. He's an English director from different economic backgrounds. And the premise was, you show me a child at seven and I'll show you the man.
Yeah.
You can see at seven what they'll become. Mm-hmm. And then every 7 years he would film them. And this longitudinal studies on film, I love them. And that's why it took me 14 years to make Following Harry.
Yeah.
And it's going to take me longer to finish the film about the women. It's called Another Night in the Free World. I'm still filming that.
Yeah.
It's I love being able to capture life as it evolves and to see those transformations and see the backdrop of life changing as well. So it's the interior life and then that whole backdrop of the world playing into it. So I want to keep on doing that, and I am.
Yeah.
So I feel very lucky in being able to carry on.
So I have one last question. Okay. For anyone who may not be familiar with the life and work of Mr. Belafonte and his artistry, his activism, is there anything specific that you'd like to share about the film that you think would convey the importance of its message and its content?
Well, it's interesting because when I was making this film originally, I was hoping it would be done before the 2016 election.
Yeah.
To help get young people out to vote. But I couldn't finish it for that. Then I thought it'd be good for the 2020 for the same reason. And I couldn't finish it for that. And now that we are where we are, I think it's very important to see the arc of history and hear the warnings in the film, what you have to look out for, and to get some hope. It gives you hope. And I think it gives you a good kick in the butt you know, to get out there. And really, we have the power to make a difference. And we do it on the community level, on the block level. You can do it in your school. But there's so many conversations and actually physical activism, nonviolent activism that has to be done to save us. And I'm not talking about saving democracy, because that means nothing to people. It's just a word, but to save humanity. And it, I think the film helps you understand the importance of staying connected. So I think it's just based on the response, even last night's audience, how people stay and they want to talk afterwards. They want to talk about it, and and it makes them think about so many things in a very different way. And Harry's words are so strong and inspiring.
Yeah.
So I think, and it's not taking medicine, it's an enjoyable and exciting experience, I think, to watch the last 12 years of Harry's life.
Yeah.
In our lives.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for wanting to speak to me.
And with KCSB News, I'm Kelly Durock.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Next, we have Robin Coleman with Peace, Love, and Pets.
Welcome to KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. Our guest today is the amazing Sarah Tomasetti, the mastermind organizer behind Wine for Paws. Every April since 2009, the Central Coast has come together to help homeless animals during Wine for Paws weekend. This year, on April 26th and 27th, over 80 businesses will join forces once again to raise money for Woods Humane Society. When you shop at participating locations, a minimum of 10% of your purchase will be donated to Woods. Sarah, welcome back to Peace, Love, and Pets.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me today.
Tell us how this all got started. Tell us how it's grown, what differences you're seeing.
Back in 2009, I had been volunteering for Woods, and we moved up to North County. At that time, there was not a North County location, and my husband and I found it more and more difficult to spend regular time in San Luis Obispo visiting the animals. So I thought I wanted to come up with something to do, something a little bit more. And we had been going out to the wineries and getting to know winery owners. And it seemed that everybody had a cat or a dog, and most of them were rescues. So I had this idea that what if they just donate a percent of sales one day to Woods Humane Society, and they loved it from the very first year. The wineries were just so into it, and it went from one day in 2009 to a whole weekend going forward. And now, actually, this year, we're looking at Wine for Paws week, because we actually have Wine for Paws month, mm-hmm. because there's a business, Soul Tree Shoes in Paso Robles, is donating 20% of all sock sales the entire month of April. So
something
it's
for everybody.
Just grown so much. It's fantastic.
And I mean, it just keeps growing. I think you almost have to limit it at this point,
because
everybody really would want to take part in it.
Yeah, I do. It has to be manageable for me. But we have, in addition to wineries, as you know, we have cider, beer, olive oil, food, and retail. So it's just grown exponentially. And it's a wonderful, wonderful weekend, wonderful week. And it's just a great way for the community to get involved and help Woods Humane Society.
And we appreciate that help. Let's talk a little bit more about the wines. I know some places get so creative. Some do a special label. Some do a special blend. And then some are just selling their regular offerings, but offering a percentage back. What are you hearing this year?
They're really working on some great things. We have Tackett Family Vineyards that's out on the east side, and they bottle a red blend every year that is made by one of their wine club members. And they have this great party where they come up with the blend, and then they vote on it, and they come up with a name, and they put a different animal on the label every year. And all of that money goes to Wine for Paws and Woods Humane Society. Hayseed and Housden is the same. They have the Pray for Love Pinot Noir that 100% of that goes to the homeless pets. And Ted is also the one who throws the annual kickoff party, which this year is on Friday night. And it's going to be held at Cal Coast Beer, because there's more room since the party's grown so much.
Yeah, that space. Yeah. Have you had some wineries with you the whole time?
Yes.
Yes, that's awesome.
Yeah, there's quite a few that are from the very beginning. Graveyard Vineyards comes to mind as one of the very first ones. Pianetta downtown is another one that's been doing it forever. You know, we've seen so many wineries come and go, but it's great to have some of those original Wine for Paws wineries still doing the event.
So what are our food options this year so far?
We have more food options than ever before. Jeffrey's Wine Country Barbecue has been doing this for many years, so they're on board again, of course. And Red Scooter Deli in downtown Paso, they're going to be donating all weekend, plus they're putting together some box lunches that's going to have a little treat for your pup in it as well. We also have a restaurant in Atascadero called Kula Hawaiian Kitchen, which is part of Kula Vineyards, and it's a great Hawaiian restaurant with poke bowls and really yummy looking food, and you can do a wine tasting and get lunch, and they're dog friendly. And then we've also got a great partnership this year with Paso Market Walk. Four of their purveyors are going to put on Super Saturday at Paso Market Walk and donate 10% of sales. And that includes the Third Degree, which is a restaurant, as well as the Vreemery. Have you heard of the Vreemery?
I have.
Amazing vegan cheese place. You would never know it's vegan.
They're like magicians.
You would
they
never
trick
know.
They you. Yeah. They really do.
And they do sandwiches and things other than just cheese. Yeah. And then Leo Gelato and Paso Market Walk. So that's really a stop on Saturday for the whole family can participate in that. Get the kids over there and get them some gelato. Make their
all
day.
Ages. They have grass yep. areas you yep. can play with. Again, very dog friendly. Yep. Definitely, we've done a few events there. And I have to say, Jeffrey's, he did some food for our little event a couple weeks ago, and he just did an amazing job. We talked all about food and Wine for Paws and all things. But he's also, you know, award winning. He's got that title for Best Mac and Cheese many, many years, and he does a great job with that.
He just won the Cipino and Vino Award for that fundraiser a couple weekends ago.
I wonder how many trophies that guy has.
I know. He has to build an extra room for all of his trophies.
Must be nice. But yes, so a great place to add to your list. Talk a little bit about the map, because you take time making the map that's accessible. I love that you can plan out, because there are different areas of the county that you do represent, and people can plan out their day and pick a few wineries that make sense that they can logistically get to, plan their meal, plan their lunch. Tell us about the map, where people can find that.
The map's going to come out in April. That will be available on the website, and you'll be able to download that on your phone as a PDF, or you can print it out if you want a hard copy to take with you. And it lists all of the participating businesses on one side, and then it's got the map on the other side. And we've got businesses from San Luis Obispo, Morro Bay. There's Absolution Cellars in Morro Bay. There's a couple wineries in Cayucas, Atascadero, Santa Margarita, Paso Robles. And so, yeah, it's all on that map for you. So you can plan your weekend and head out and have a great time.
I have to say, I went to Niner Winery for the first time several years back during a Wine for Paws weekend. Mm-hmm. Somebody else had made the reservations, made the plan, and there are just so many wineries, and sometimes you don't know where to start, don't know which one to go to. And I had driven by it so many times, and I just assumed, you know, it's fancy there, or I can't get in there. You have to have an appointment. And wow, did my life change after that first lunch at the Niner Winery for Wine for Paws.
Great.
Yes. I would love to sit here and talk about the wine, but I have to talk about the food, because that is what, like, I still dream about that focaccia bread. I still dream about their charcuterie platter. They do everything so well there. So I always think of Wine for Paws as a chance to try a new winery, go somewhere you haven't been yet. And that is what, and I became a member shortly after that. And my life has been changed because of that Wine for Paws weekend that I fell in love at Niner Winery.
I love that. They have such great food there. They really do. And that's, you know, we have, 400 wineries around on the Central Coast. And so this kind of helps narrow it down for you.
Yeah, because I'm definitely going to pick the ones that are supporting Woods. Yeah. That's why I said, you know what? I'm going to try it. This is the weekend that we're going to try a couple new places. And again, opens you up to possibly becoming a member, possibly coming back for more, but also just being able to realize that they have a full menu. That's amazing.
Yeah. Like, and they're listed on the food page as well. Good. If you go to the food page on the website, it will list those restaurants that I mentioned. But there's also 8 or 9 wineries that have an on-site restaurant. So you can plan your whole day around the Wine for Paws event. And there's no tickets to buy. You don't have to pre-register. You just support those businesses that weekend or that week for those that are starting early, like Bijou on the park downtown Paso Robles. She is hosting an all-day sip and shop on Wednesday, April 23rd.
And that's a retail store for people that know. It's a
great clothing store.
Cool, trendy, great retail spot, but is also bringing in some bubbles, bringing in some fun stuff for, I think, the whole day?
The whole day, including puppuccinos.
Puppuccinos.
So
I knew there was something
else.
I love that.
Yeah, it's a really fun day. I will be there at some point during the day for sure. And I'll bring Tater, and Tater will get her puppuccino.
Puppuccinos, what else do we need? That's a perfect weekend.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just love every year they come up with such fun, creative things. I know it started with like donating some wine tasting fees or a percentage back. And then every year they come up with such fun, creative. I know you've had fashion shows before. You've had vineyard walks. You've had all kinds of fun things in the past. And I was already checking out your website this year several times and seeing some really fun stuff coming up. I would love to chat more about some of the specific events that are around Wine for Paws weekend. I think some have some different dates and times, but I love bingo. I'm a crazy bingo person. So tell me, I saw that you posted a new event, bingo for Woods.
I'm so excited about this. I'm so working on getting a group of people together because I think the funnest Sunday sounds like brunch, bingo, and vino. And that's going to be at MCV Wines. They're in the Tin City Annex. And it's going to be 20% of the ticket cost gets donated to Woods. You're going to get a bingo card. And then any additional bingo cards will be $10. And all of that will be donated. And then MCV will be including your first glass of wine with the ticket. And all wine sales by the glass or bottle will be donated at 20%. And
that's
it
awesome.
Just sounds like so much fun.
It does. If you're just joining us, you are listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. And my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Sarah Tomasetti with Wine for Paws. We are talking all things Wine for Paws. You mentioned the kickoff party. We talked about bingo. I saw there's a new pup-friendly movie option, which I love.
Yes.
You can watch I think it's Homeward Bound with your dog at a winery.
Yes, Dracena Wines. They're downtown Paso Robles. They actually did it last year as well.
Fun.
And it's bring your pup to the movies, and it's $10, and you can bring your pup, and they're going to watch a movie and drink wine, and it looks like it's just going to be the cutest thing ever.
This is so perfect.
Yeah.
I just love all of these fun things. Any other fun events? I think you said you're working on some more.
I know we have a couple wineries working on Yappy Hour. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple Paint Your Pets. There's one at J. Ducey Wines, and there's one at Castoro Cellars. And there's going to be a lot of live music. And I know somebody's working on getting a mobile dog groomer to come out and have someone on site.
Okay.
So you could bring your dog and get him a bath.
Take care of business while
donated.
You drink some wine.
Exactly.
I like it. So you mentioned that it's not a ticketed event, but there are a few of these events that are ticketed.
The kickoff party and the Paint Your Pets and the Sunday brunch bingo and vino, those are ticketed events.
Okay.
And the rest are just head out to the wineries and they're going to donate 10% of your sales. And if you can't make it to the wineries, they're doing online sales as well. And a lot of them will be offering wine sales and shipping specials. And that will all be on the website as we get closer to the date.
But I think it's also really great that you are bringing over 80 different local businesses. You're also engaging an audience of new people to these awesome local wineries.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's the whole idea, was that we were hoping to give the participating wineries a little extra boost in business that weekend. And in return, Woods gets a donation out of it. And a lot of these wineries are really small. And there are a lot of them people haven't heard of before.
Right.
And they go and they find these little wineries and they are just blown away.
Yeah.
It's great.
Wine and pets just seem to go together so perfectly. Wine people are just pet people for some reason.
It's the perfect blend, right?
It is the perfect blend. Some of my favorite adoptions over the years, you know, I've been at Woods over 10 years, are like a, you know, community cat that comes in to get altered and he's all scarred and beat up and you can tell he's gone through it. And we realized this cat's pretty friendly. He's pretty social. I think he could go on the adoption floor. And they end up getting adopted and becoming winery cats. And then they're roaming around all day at a winery. They become little celebrities almost. Or think of a valley dog that was discarded in a field days from being euthanized at a rural shelter with no resources. And they come to Woods, they get adopted, and now they're greeting people at a winery and running around the vineyard all day. These are the stories that we get to hear at Woods. And so many of them are intersected somehow with a winery.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite stories from Woods, and I think this is a great example of, you know, the money that's going to be raised this weekend helps Woods provide such an important service to our community. That story of Jefferson,
yeah,
who was there for how long?
Over 500 days.
Gosh.
Yeah. So he is a perfect example of where these funds go. To care for a dog over 500 days, he had some medical challenges over the way. Our behavior team spent a lot of time with him just to care for him, house him, feed him, give him the care that he needs and deserves. That's a big commitment for any animal shelter while also caring for hundreds of other animals. But as long as he could hang in there, they have a home at Woods. You know, he didn't give up and we didn't give up. And over 520 days it took, but Jefferson got adopted recently and he is in a home. It wasn't the right time for many months, but they ended up losing their senior dogs pretty close together. They took a little bit of time and they just got that feeling that Jefferson was the dog for them to care for these animals, to be able to house them and care for them and give them medical care, whatever they need. Takes a lot of money when you know, we are a nonprofit. Yeah. We have to fundraise a lot of money to care for all of these animals. So Jefferson is just one of the many examples, but a great example.
And you never gave up?
We didn't give up and he didn't give up. You know, we brought over 40 animals from LA County shelters to help them with their space. And I'm very happy to say most have been adopted already. A few are still on the adoption floor. But out of over 40 cats and dogs, we have just a few LA County shelter animals that are still waiting for their forever home. And if we weren't fundraising, we would not be able to do that.
I love it. You were just recently doing the free...
We do
vaccination
free, yep, still we have some vaccine clinics. We do a couple times a year. We try to do some microchip clinics a few times a year, but we do them so reasonably, $20 usually, yeah, to get a microchip. And then once a month in our North County location, we do a bunch of community cats. We alter them. We get them fixed up, whatever they need at that time. Then they go back out into their communities that they were in. Every dollar we raise is another life that we get to say yes to.
And this is one of the most fun ways to raise money.
Too bad, right?
You know, if you live here, you're going to go out wine tasting at least a few weekends a year, right?
Yes.
So why not do it this weekend? Because it's a no-brainer. The money's going to such a great cause.
So tell us how we can find all things out Wine for Paws.
Wine for Paws. Wine4paws.com. That's the handle on social media, and that is the website, wineforpaws.com. It's got a list of all the participating businesses, all the special events that are going on that weekend, as well as coming in April, we will have the map available, free to print or download. And again, to go out and participate that weekend, you don't have to buy a ticket. The ticketed events are extra things. Mm-hmm. You can just pick some wineries, pick one winery if you want to. Go buy some wine. You just raise money for homeless pets.
Do we forget anything? Do we miss anything?
I think we've got it
covered.
So
much. Okay.
Starting April 23rd. When we have Bijou Downtown, a retail store, and that same night is the Dracaena movie night. Okay. And then moving on into the weekend, the kickoff party is Friday, April 25th. All weekend long, the wineries are donating. And then Sunday is that bingo, brunch bingo,
bingo!
And vino.
The not silent bingo.
The
right?
Not silent okay. Bingo, right?
Well, as I wrap up here, I want to thank my guest, Sarah Tomasetti with Wine for Paws. Thank you for all you are doing and have done in the community, helping people and pets and wineries. On April 6th at Woods in San Luis Obispo, we are hosting a kitten shower to kick off kitten season. Our foster program will be there and can answer questions, give demos. You can RSVP to that on our website. On April 13th, Rose the Slow Way, another fun party in San Luis Obispo. Tickets are on sale. It is a fabulous, fashionable rosé pink party at Hotel Slow. The weekend of the 26th and 27th is Wine for Paws weekend. Visit us at woodshumane.org and follow us at Woods Humane Society on Facebook and Instagram for the cutest content. Thank you for listening to Peace, Love, and Pets. I'm Robin with Woods. Don't forget, your new best friend is waiting for you at the shelter.
Up next, KCBX's Tom Wilmer talks California wine and history with Sean Weir, author of Mad Crush.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
I'm Sean Weir, author of The Mad Crush, an obscure California vineyard and the quest to make great wine.
Going back in time, you went to Cal Poly?
I did, yeah. Yeah. That's how I landed down here.
When you went to work as a cellar rat, were you still a student?
I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Napa, Sonoma area and did a couple years of junior college up there. And then,
did you have a connection with the wine industry growing up?
I did. It was part of the fabric of the culture up there. So when you were playing Little League, you were playing against teams sponsored by Sebastiani and Parducci, and then going to high school with a bunch of winemakers' kids. And when I was in junior college, I started working in restaurants, and that's when I got an early dose of wine appreciation, age 19, 20. Mm-hmm. And then when I went down to Cal Poly to finish up college, I worked in local tasting rooms and got interested in the actual process of making wine. So I actually left a little early to come back up north, worked a harvest at Kenwood Vineyards, and then spent a year on the lamb before going back to Poly. And at that point, it was the fall quarter, so I ended up working at Sausalito Canyon Vineyard for the 1992 harvest.
And that was the genesis of the book you wrote.
It was, yeah. That was my first tour out in the canyon, Sausalito Canyon Vineyard, an old vine Zinfandel vineyard that had been planted in 1880 and restored in 1974.
Some of the oldest vines in the state of California of Zin, right?
They are, yeah. It's the original roots still. They're now 144 years old and still producing wine.
Tell us the story how the Greenos found those old grapevines and how they breathed new life into them.
Yeah, the book is really, it's technically a memoir. It's my story of being out there, but I use that to tell this larger story of the history of the vineyard, how it came to be, what happened to it through the decades. So you fast forward from 1880 to 1974, and there's this character, Bill Greeno, who grew up in Montecito. He kind of burned out on the sort of upper crust life that he'd grown up in Montecito, ended up in the Mountain Drive Bohemian community up in the mountains of Santa Barbara. Up there, they had communal winemaking. So he kind of got the wine bug with his neighbors making wine, kind of moonshine up there in the hills. And he had a friend, Michael Benedict of Sanford and Benedict Vineyard, who turned him on to, hey, you could do this too because we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And so he went on the lookout for his own slice of viticultural paradise and ended up way out in the upper Arroyo Grande Valley off the grid. And he found this old vineyard. It was ensnared in brush and it had gone native. And he decided that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to bring that vineyard back to life and ultimately make wine from it.
That's so cool. Talk to us about Old Vine Zin and how those characteristics are distinctive.
Yeah, it's hard to put your finger on, but as the vines grow old, and in this case go native, there's a certain sort of aromatic complexity and etherealness that you get on the palate that you just can't get with younger vines. And even out there, there's a trace of what I would call sort of chaparral, mm-hmm. which is, you know, sort of the native landscape there. There's a certain aroma when the wind in the summertime blows off the chaparral, and I could swear you can smell that in that Sausalito Canyon.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So classic terroir.
It sure is, yeah.
Yeah. And the soils, are they poor man's soils?
They are, which is good for wine, right? Because it concentrates the flavors. It doesn't retain a lot of water. And so instead of these big, fat, sort of flavorless, juicy grapes, you get these small, intensely flavored grapes. And what's interesting, I think it's maybe 15 miles from the ocean, way up in the upper Arroyo Grande Valley. I mean, it's got elevation. Mm-hmm. But the soils are riddled with marine fossils, which sort of blows your mind.
Again, these vines survived on their own with nobody watering or doing anything.
They barely survived. Mm-hmm. So the vineyard was producing fruit through Prohibition for Sacramento wines. But at some point, they were abandoned. Mm-hmm. So for at least a couple decades, they'd gone native. And when Bill was out there looking around, the realtor brought him out there, and there was these sort of old stumps ensnared in, you know, poison oak and dry brush. And the way he told it is that he's sort of rooting around there, peeling back the brush, expecting that he's going to have to just rip these out and replant. And lo and behold, there's these little grape clusters. And because wow. they've been covered up in the brush, mm-hmm. the exposed parts were the fruit would be eaten by animals. But underneath the brush, where the deer couldn't get, things like that, this thing was still producing fruit. And that's when he got the idea, hey, I can chop the crowns off but keep the roots and retrain them back up and create fresh vines from the old roots.
Did he do a head pruning style?
He did, yeah. Mm-hmm. The classic head pruning style that you see in every old photo of California viticulture going back to the mid-1800s.
Mm-hmm. And so through today, his son and family continue making wine from those grapes, right?
Yeah, they do. His son, Tom. Right, he's the winemaker now. So you think about how cool that is. Bill's been out there since 1974, and his son Tom, I think, has been winemaker for maybe upwards of 15 years now, and Bill and his wife Nancy are still actively involved.
Oh, that's really cool.
And Bill's sister, Margaret, as well. So it's a multi-generational family affair, and if you look back to 1880, it started out with an itinerant Englishman and his wife who planted the vineyard. How they got out there, I mean, it's hard to get out there by car now, so how they got out there with a horse and plows.
And getting out there is only half the dynamic.
Yeah.
Once you're out there and you crush and you make your product, you got to get the horse and buggy to transport.
Yeah, yeah. How they did it, I have no idea. But and that's the cool thing. It's not just the Greenos, but it's all the lives that that place and that those vines have touched over the past nearly 150 years. You read the stories in the book, and it's not just me, it's not just Bill or Tom. It's people over the decades before us whose life trajectory was changed by these vines.
Let's step back to the point in time when you were working out there as a young punk cellar rat.
That's right. That's a good term. Young punk cellar rat. That's exactly what it was.
And there were some characters that you worked with that were right from central casting.
Yeah. Out there, they say that there's the right way and the wrong way, and then there's the Sausalito way, which I think is a very apt phrase. And I had the good fortune to be out there in the 1995 harvest. This is 3 years after I worked there while I was at Cal Poly. Bill called me to come back. And I threw everything in my truck, my cat rode shotgun, and down I went. It was an opportunity of a lifetime to go down there and live on the property in the winery cabin. That harvest just so happened we assembled kind of a random team of cellar rats and other assorted itinerant individuals, and we all came together as a unit and just had just a great time.
Highlight of a couple of the memorable characters.
Well, there was Peter, who had worked there some vintages before. And he was a live wire, a jokester, drove the forklift like a madman, always good for a laugh, very hard worker, would show up late, but once he was there, he was totally on task and just a riot to be around. We had some people come and go, couldn't hack it. We had Adam, the drummer, who was, you know, maybe less into it than some of us, but, you know, he was a good guy to have around. And just, yeah, there was a whole stream of people who came and joined us, and ultimately we made a great wine somehow, some way.
That's really cool. A little bit more about Sausalito Canyon and what they do today and what their lexicon is, what they produce.
Of course, the heart of the operation now is still the old Vine Zinfandel. They make a wine.
Have they done cuttings and rooting?
I believe that people have taken cuttings from them and planted their own vines from that vineyard, but I would have to kind of ask them the details. Yeah. But they do make a wine they call 1880, which is exclusively from the head-trained old vines planted in 1880.
And that's an award winner, right?
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah. And then they have their estate Zinfandel, and then they source fruit from other vineyards on the Central Coast and make some interesting blends. And they have a little Cabernet planting out there, part of what they call the Bordeaux Triangle back in the day, because of the triangular-shaped block. That was the only thing that wasn't Zinfandel planted.
So that's really what they're known for, then?
Yes.
Is their Zin?
Absolutely.
Their tasting room, they have one, right, still? Mm-hmm. That's not where the grapes are grown.
Right, right. They have a tasting room out there on Biddle Ranch Road in Edna Valley. Easy to find. Cool little spot. I was out there for a wine club event recently and got to hang out with Nancy and Bill and talked to a lot of the wine club members who'd read the book, and that was really gratifying. Yeah. The vineyard is a whole other story, because that's, to get up there, you have to go around by Lopez Lake and then drive out further and then come to a gate and go to a mile and a half down a pitted dirt road to get to the vineyard. So, you know, some people for some of the private events and tastings have been out there, and it was really gratifying to talk to some of them, because they've gone out there after reading the book and they're like, it's just like you painted it. So that's very gratifying.
That's really cool. And reeling back in time, the Englishman, why did he buy and create this property so remote? Was it because that's all he could afford?
Personally, I just don't know that story. Bill's never really told me any more than I know, so I'm not sure he knows or they know. Mm-hmm. But his name was Harry Ditmas. He had done different things. He'd been a grocer in Avila Beach. Some way and for some reason, he found his way up there to the Rio Grande Valley into the area called Rancho Sausalito, which is Sausalito for small willow trees. And he and his wife, Rosa, planted fruit trees and vines, lived out there and homesteaded it.
In your book, some of the areas that you focus on, which are closest to your heart, that bring a smile to you when you recall?
Yeah, there are a couple things. One thing that I really like about the book is that a lot of people have told me that it's the first time they really understood how wine is made from ground to glass. It walks you through that in a very approachable, unpretentious way because it's very real. It's all true. It's very authentic. It's gritty. There's no gloss, no bullshit, right? So I was careful, too, when writing the book, conscious of people who may be wine curious or not even into wine, but maybe interested to know how it's really made and what goes into it. And so that's a part of the book that I really enjoy is sort of spelling it all out as I experienced it and as I learned it.
So you've encountered some enophiles and venophiles that love the book and some that knew nothing about that whole world, the backside of the story.
Yeah, I think that there are people who've taken wine tours and it's sort of gone in one ear and out the other. This book spells it out, I think, a little more clearly and a little more approachably. I think it's a book for not only people who are into wine, but maybe just wine curious. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a book for people who maybe aren't even into wine because it touches on a lot of other things like California history and cultural milestones. So I would say a wine book that is something people who are not into wine might want to read is probably the ultimate compliment.
Within the book, there are certain moments where you can't help but to crack up and to laugh. And so at some point, you left Sausalito Canyon and you moved on. What tantalized you? What tempted you to leave?
Yeah, that's a story into itself. You know, when Bill called me to come down, my dad died when I was 21, right? Oh. So this is like 3 years on from that, 4 years on. And I've been kind of adrift in life. I was sort of aimless. Post-college, wasn't really doing anything.
What did you major in? What did you think you were going to do?
Well, I majored in journalism.
Okay.
I thought I might be a journalist and a writer, but after 4 years, I was a catering waiter, kind of living the Santa Cruz life, which wasn't bad, but I was a little adrift. And I think, you know, that maybe goes back to having that life moment that changed things pretty dramatically. And Bill calls me down there, and he turned out to be a bit of a mentor and a father figure himself at, I think, the right time in my life. So I'm out there for 2.5 months. I am working 50, 60, sometimes 70 hours a week. I'm living on property. I don't have time to spend the money I'm making. And I get spit out the other end 2.5 months later. All the wine's barreled down. Like I say in the book, Bill and Nancy didn't have to tell me or ask me. They were too polite to ask me to leave, but it was kind of obvious as I was starting to work 20 hours a week, then 15, then 10. It's like, all right, it's time to go.
Party's over.
Yeah, yeah. So I came out with sort of a renewed sense of energy and purpose. I think it was a boot in the ass just at the right time in my life. And so I came out of there and an old catering friend said, hey, I'm leaving this place in Pebble Beach. I'm a caretaker for rent. Do you want to take my place? So I'm like, okay, so I've got some money in the bank. I've got free rent and I can live in Pebble Beach.
Wow.
So that was pretty good.
Yeah.
So from there, I was able to focus on what I was meant to do, which is write. And so that was the moment I became dedicated to what I should be doing. And I turned into a freelance journalist pretty quickly, and sort of the rest is history.
So were you writing for magazines?
I was, yeah, magazines, newspapers.
And what sort of focus?
My focus was environmental issues, travel, and wine.
At some point, you morphed and moved on from just being a freelance journalist.
I did. I had the good fortune of sort of taking what I'd learned on the journalism side through Cal Poly and through my personal experience as a freelance journalist, and then take that to the other side of the coin doing public relations, which happened to be the concentration of journalism that I studied.
Did you go to work for a PR firm?
I went to work for a company. I finally threw in the towel after 3 or 4 years of doing freelance journalism. It's a tough way to go.
Yeah, reinventing yourself every week.
Exactly. So I took a PR job with an environmental company up in the Marin County area.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I got back into wine.
And somehow you got back down to Paso and the Central Coast.
I did,
yeah. How did that happen?
Well, I was at this job up in Marin County and wasn't liking it too much. You know, it just wasn't my jam. Like a lot of Cal Poly students, I wanted to get back to the Central Coast because once you get a taste of it, it's hard to resist. Mm-hmm. It's a common tale. People graduate, they leave, but they want to come back. So it's back in the day when you would print out paper resumes, and I put out resumes. I said, look, I want to take these skills and my passion for wine, put them together, get back into the wine business. So I sent resumes to a bunch of wineries. Winery from the Central Coast called. I said, let's go. Came back down and been here ever since.
So you've been kind of a rogue freelancer as a PR person, right? You're a hired gun.
I am, yeah.
And your clients might change and evolve over time.
Right, right. But we've had the good fortune. My wife and I have our own consultancy, and we've had the good fortune to work with a lot of our clients for 5, 10, 15, even 20 years.
Oh, wow. And you have some favorites. We were talking about Firestone.
Oh, earlier. Yeah. I've been working with Fire. In fact, that was the winery that responded to me was Firestone Vineyard down in Santa Barbara County.
Oh, cool.
Adam Firestone and his family had started the winery in the 70s. Actually, Brooks Firestone started the winery. Adam is his son. Adam was the president of the winery at the time. And he hired me. And he said, by the way, I've got this little brewery in the back 40 of the vineyard, you're doing that too. Well, over time, brewery outshot the winery. They eventually sold the winery, and the brewery's going strong now.
It's going strong. Every time I go up 101 northbound, there's a whole, like, a sub-city south of Paso that's Firestone World.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an incredible success story.
Yeah, it is, and still family-operated, second generation, like Sausalito Canyon. Nick Firestone's heading things up, Adam's son now.
How would somebody find out more about you?
You can go to themadcrush.com. You can go to Sean Weir, S-E-A-N-W-A-I-R.
Years ago, I read your book, and then all of a sudden it popped up again as a new book. So was it a rewrite or an evolution to it? And I remember there's a postscript about Avila and your connection there, like going back in time.
The Mad Crush was published originally in 2015. It's self-published. About 6 months after putting the book out, I was like, oh, I should have included this or that. You know, in an optimal, perfect world setting, I would have. But in the rush to put it all together, there were some things I felt like I left on the table. And over time, there were more memories and things that came to mind talking to Bill. And I thought, you know, at about 9 years after the first edition, I thought, you know, it's time to kind of do and put back in the things that I felt were left out. Enough time had gone by to breathe new life into the book, into the story. So I took these old stories that I'd left out and surgically put them into the existing book. So it's not a new book in the sense of it's something that I thought was just an even richer reading experience. So it added about 30 pages to the original book. Then there were other stories that I felt didn't quite fit in the original story, but I was still enamored with telling them. And so I added those to the back in a separate section called Prunings. That's where those little short stories exist. So they're kind of like a little add-on.
Teaser of what they are.
There's one on fruit sorting, and there's one about me thinking my cat got killed by a predator at night. There's one about Chamazal Vineyard working out there and some things that went on there. And then there is finally a little mini chapter on my time and experience out in Avila Beach and what happened there.
And that is a huge happening, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
You barely recognize it for anybody that was there in the prior iteration.
Yeah, I lived near Avila Beach when I was at Poly and loved going out there. And it was really a kind of an off-the-radar place and kind of funky and industrial and artistic. Then there was a persistent oil line leak under the beach, and finally they had to dig the whole town up. And the chapter's about what happened there, how the town was torn asunder, and how maybe it lost a little bit of its heart and soul along the way.
Well, I think what it lost was kind of that New England seaport feel to it. That's all gone.
Yeah. The reason I wrote that is because change came so swiftly because of this environmental calamity. So usually things sort of evolve and change over time. Mm-hmm. But in this case, the whole town was torn up, rebuilt, and reimagined within 18 to 24 months. And that's a highly unusual circumstance.
Once again, to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
I would go to themadcrush.com.
Sean, thank you so much for sharing. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.